This is an oral history interview with Mel Elder. The date is Monday, August 1st, 2005. All right, could you tell me your full name?
Melvin Leroy Elder.
And when and where were you born?
In Washington County, Kansas.
Your birth date was?
June 29th, 1924.
Now, did you grow up in Washington, Kansas then? You spent your childhood there?
Out in the rural area. I was born and lived there, went through grade school and high school, and then went in the Navy in World War II.
Mm-hmm. How big is Washington, Kansas? Is Washington a city? Washington is a city?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a county, county seat.
The county seat. Okay, so what's your wife's name?
Edna May Elder.
And her maiden name was?
Stoffel.
Stoffel. And when was she born?
She was born September 2nd, 1927.
When did you meet her? How did you meet her?
They moved up in our part of the country, 30 or 40 miles south, and they moved right across the road from us.
Uh-huh.
And this is out in the country, and we went to the same country school together. Might say grew up together. She had 9 brothers and 4 sisters. 13. Anyway, we went to the same country grade school together, and that's where our acquaintance began.
Then, when did you begin dating in earnest?
1943.
Were you already out of school then?
I think I had graduated. She was still in high school.
Uh-huh. Now, did you get married to her before you came to Oregon?
Yes. I got discharged in St. Louis, Missouri from the Navy.
Uh-huh.
Went up to Kansas and we got married. Didn't have any means of transportation, so we took a bus from Washington, Kansas to Tillamook, Oregon.
That doesn't sound like a honeymoon trip.
Well, we tried to make it a honeymoon trip.
Uh-huh.
We stayed overnight or two in Denver,
uh-huh.
and then in Salt Lake,
uh-huh.
we spent a night or two. And then she had an uncle and aunt that lived in Bend, and we went by to see them. And against our wishes, we stayed there about 3 or 4 days. They had a house sitting job out at Alfalfa,
uh-huh.
Oregon, which is right out in the middle of the sagebrush.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know, well, don't you want to go out there with us? And sure, we'll go out there. Well, they didn't say they were going to be out there about 3 or 4 days. Well, we sat out there and played solitaire for a lot longer than we wanted to.
Uh-huh. So that was just a visit on your way?
Yeah.
Did you come to Oregon for a reason then, other than that you just got married? Is that what, was there a reason that brought you to Oregon?
Well, my parents had moved to Oregon. They sold out farm equipment, farming, and they moved to Tillamook, where my sister and my wife's brother lived. He was in the Navy blimp service at Tillamook, and he was moonlighting at a sign company there at Bay City, just out of Tillamook. So I went on leave there and met his boss, and the boss told me he would hold a job for me when I got discharged. So that's kind of the story.
How long before you were discharged?
Oh, I think it was about 4 or 5 months.
And he offered to hold this job all
yes.
that time while you
yes,
were...
Yes, he did.
Were jobs in scarce supply at that
time? Well, no, they weren't.
Oh, okay.
I figured they would be real scarce because all uh-huh. these guys getting discharged from the service after the war, and here I had a free college education if I would have taken it, but I was getting pretty old. I was up there about 21 years old, and I didn't have time to fool around with college.
When you came out to Tillamook, did you originally intend to stay out here when you first came?
Oh, yes.
You did?
Oh, yeah, very much
Even
so.
Though you didn't know what you were going to do at that time?
Right.
Right away, I should
yeah.
say. So you were actually still technically in the Navy when you first came to
yes,
Oregon?
Yes, I was. Yes.
And were you stationed out here, or just visiting it on the
well,
first
after
time?
I came back from overseas, I didn't have enough points to get out of the Navy, and they stationed me at the receiving station at out of Seattle,
Bremerton
Navy Yards.
Uh-huh.
And then they give me an assignment to board a newly built aircraft carrier at Tacoma. So I helped take it on shakedown cruise, and then eventually we went down through the canal and went up to Boston Navy Yards. And that's where I left the carrier and went to St. Louis and got discharged.
I see. But the bottom line would be that after that, you have been an Oregon resident continuously from that time.
Yes.
Okay. So let's move ahead then and talk about how you landed in Union County here in LeGrand. You were telling about that you had an opportunity to learn the sign business. You did that in Tillamook before you came here.
Yeah, at Bay City.
So let's briefly talk about the learning the sign business when you went back to Tillamook. Who taught you that? And
okay,
and
the owner of the sign company was an excellent neon tube vendor. Besides owning the business and running it, that was his profession. And he taught me the neon tubing and process it.
What was his name?
Bill Sherman. Uh-huh. W.K. Sherman.
Now, was there did you have to have a license or a certification in order to do this kind of sign work?
I was on an apprenticeship, a state apprenticeship, and after serving my apprenticeship of 3 years, I got a journeyman card. And at that time, he started at Neon Tube Bending School in Portland for veterans. And he left me in charge. He more or less lost interest in the sign company and got to the place I couldn't charge anything to materials. He wouldn't pay the bills. And finally, my paycheck started bouncing. And so I quit. And went to work for the Tillamook County Creamery Association on a route selling dairy products. And previously, when I was working for Mr. Sherman, we'd built a pretty good size neon sign, and we didn't have too much know-how on to hang a good size sign like that, so electrical products company in Portland sent one of their men down to help us. And I got acquainted with him, and at a later date when I was working for the creamery, he had came to Pendleton and bought a sign company there. And then he heard about the one in LeGrand being for sale. So he called me and told me about it. He said I ought to get on that, which I did.
What was his name?
Milton Berger. Jules Milton Berger.
Mm-hmm. And he's the I think he's now deceased, right?
Yes.
Owner of what has evolved into a company over there called Sign Man.
Yeah, I think it was Eastern Oregon.
Because his son had
it one time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, first of all, let's go back. You got your journeyman's card. What was the trade called?
Neon Sign Man. Neon Sign Man.
And there was an apprenticeship or trade resulted in a license or a certification for that.
Yeah.
You don't just walk in and do it.
No, that's true.
Okay.
However, when it comes into the licensing, that's more or less to do with the electrical part. So we always had to carry electrical contractor's license.
To work around electricity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Mr. Mildenberger told you about the sign company that was for sale over here in Le Grand. What was it called?
Grand Ron Neon.
And I know there's quite a story about that getting started in that business over here. You told me in our initial meeting that was about 1949.
Yes.
That you bought that company. How did that work out? What happened with that?
Well, it was a real struggle. We bought out fellows. Olin Chancellor was his name. He had been the superintendent of the Grand Ron Hospital, and they had taken the sign company in on a bill.
Uh-huh.
So he took over the sign company and quit his job at the hospital. And not knowing anything about signs, he didn't make a go of it. So he was wanting to get rid of it. And had we known, of course, we could have started our own just as well. It was a real struggle getting going, probably 4 or 5 years. And it so happened that I brought a fellow that I'd worked with over on the coast to go in partnerships with. And I didn't really know him that well. He was a sign painter, and I was not a sign painter. And so I needed his services, and it turned out that, make a long story short, he was an alcoholic, unbeknownst to me, and Keith Rowe, who was...
What was his name?
J.W. Weiser, he was known as Bud Weiser.
Bud Weiser.
I think he did justice to the name.
Did he? Now, were there other sign companies in the area when you came? Was there another sign company?
Sign painting company, Worley Sign Company.
What happened with them?
As time went on, as we built our business, his business just completely disappeared practically. He eventually left town.
Because they weren't as motivated or skilled or hustlers or what?
I think quality of work had a lot to do with it. It got pretty competitive there for a while, and we happened to be the winners.
You talked about there were two mistakes made in this business when you came over, one of them being that maybe you should have started from scratch on your own, and the other one was that your partner choice might have been a mistake.
Yes.
Is that what caused you to struggle for so long in the beginning?
That had something to do with it, because it was a matter of working almost 7 days a week and long hours to develop enough income to make a living for both families and keep the business going.
How did you come to the decision that you needed to unload your partner?
Well, it was just a matter of fact that he didn't ever come to work anymore. He quit coming to work.
Uh-huh. You talked about going to Kansas on a vacation.
Yeah. My wife's family, the 13 children, had never been together all at one time. And they decided to have a reunion, and that was in 1950, and so we just made up our mind we were going to go to it regardless of what happened. And I knew when we came back that there was going to have to be a change. And it just so happened when we returned that Keith Rowe, who was a native of the Grand, he and his wife had been back in Kansas City, and he was learning the sign business back there. He was already a very good artist. And he was also going to guard school there. Well, he had finished his apprenticeship and came back to the Grand and met Bud Weiser while I was gone. And so when we got home, I met Keith, and I said, Keith, how would you like to go into business with Bud Weiser? And he said, that's the last thing I would ever do. Well, I said, how about you and I? And he lit up and he said, you bet. So we dug up enough, I think it was $500, and paid him off, just enough to get him out of town, and we almost had to throw him out.
Huh.
But he had no investment in the business whatsoever, and so anything he got was a plus.
So the buyout was pretty easy then?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So did he actually have to sign off on that?
I don't think we ever signed anything.
I see. So now, how long did you stay in business with Keith Rowe?
I think it was 7 years.
Yeah. Was that a good relationship?
Pardon?
Was that a good relationship?
Basically, yes. It was good and bad. One of the worst parts of it was that production didn't go on all the time. When I had to go out and meet a customer and sell him a job, Keith always wanted to go along. And things like that, the production just came to a standstill. And looking back, I know we probably goofed off quite a bit. We both like to fish and hunt and everything. But anyway, as time went on, he became unhappy for the fact that we weren't getting ahead very much, and I was feeling the same way. And he decided he wanted to go to Pendleton and set up a shop over there, so I bought him out. And I hired a sign painter.
So then you just assumed control of the company without a partner?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Then, so at that time then, when you were working together, was it that you were out hustling for business and doing the business aspect, and he was doing production?
Yeah, we both did production.
Was that kind
of
just? But was that sort of your split?
Somebody had to do the legwork, and when he came here, he never had any experience whatsoever. He didn't even know how to write a check, so I took that on to myself to do that part of it. I think there ended up to be a bit of a jealousy there that caused him to be unhappy and want to go out on his own.
Mm-hmm. So then you stayed independent then after he left the business, you owned it yourself?
Yes.
How long did you own that business? When did you retire?
Maybe we were in business 35 years.
Uh-huh.
And so 7 from 35 would be 40.
Well, 35 added on to 49
years
would be like 84, 1984.
Yeah, I retired when I was 60, and I'm 81 now. It was 21 years ago.
Okay. Who'd you sell the business to?
A couple of the guys that had been working for me for considerable time, I put them through the apprenticeship. Ralph Moore was a senior, age-wise, and his son-in-law at the time, Matt Barber. They took it on a partnership basis.
And they own that business now?
Ralph has since retired, and Matt has it by himself.
Now that's currently called the Grand Ron Sign Company.
Yes.
And where is it located now?
It's out on Cove Avenue. I don't know the exact address. But
Is that where it was when you retired?
No.
Where
did it was
you?
On Cove Avenue, but it was near the underpass.
So it's
just south of the underpass.
I see. Where were you first located when you came to town?
Right down on Adams or Depot Street. Yeah,
down there. Well, that's like say Depot and Jefferson there by the railroad.
Yeah, it's
company.
Now Red Cross parking lot. There.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were in a building there. It didn't even have a truck door, just a walk-in door. And
yeah, so that wasn't a parking lot at that time. There
no,
was
no.
A building there.
No, there was three buildings. There was a barber shop next to the alley, and then us, and then a restaurant on the corner.
Remember the name of the restaurant?
Corner and Lunch.
And it burned down?
Yeah, that whole half block burned out.
Is that what caused you to move? Had you moved
already? No, we'd already moved down on Adams Avenue. I believe it was 1515 Adams. Yeah, next to that Chevron station that's there now across from Globe Ranger.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure how many years we stayed there. It was a big wooden construction building, and OK Rubber Welders was in the front, and we were in the rear. We had half of it.
And did you rent that building or buy it?
We rented it. No.
So let's talk about who your customers were. Who were some of your customers? You've already told me a couple of interesting stories about that.
Well, I think the first neon sign that I did was for D&B Donut Shop, which is now Sugar and
Joe and Sugar.
Joe and Sugar, it? Yeah.
Uh-huh. Coffee company or?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of a sign was it?
It was a neon window sign, relatively good size, had multiple colors. And interesting enough, the owners, Dick Hartsock and Bud Bennett, had just moved out from Nebraska. And Bud Bennett was younger, and he was kind of a, you might say, a son of theirs. Just they had watched out for him. They've been in the bakery business back there, so they came out here and started this donut shop. It went on for a good many years, and then Dick Hartsock became the county assessor, and Bennett took over the Dine and Donut Shop by himself, and eventually sold it.
I see. So you made that sign for them. Who else did you make signs for?
Oh, gosh. We did work for just about every sign or every business in town. Early on, I don't know, one of the major signs we did was for Royal Cafe. And it was located right across from the new building that's on Adams. What do they call that new building?
The ODS building.
No, the one on Adams Avenue.
Oh, on Adams.
And Key West, yeah, that's brand new.
Uh-huh.
It's right across the street from there. And we built a marquee-type sign. Had flashing light bulbs on, and it was pretty attractive for that day and age. then there was a vertical sign went with it. And then eventually they moved down to the Foley building, where, golly, won't be in there now, where the restaurant was that moved it. Well, anyway, it's on the cross from the city building. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we moved all that sign, installed it on the front there. Luckily it fit real well.
Yeah.
And Trotters, we did sign work for Trotters as a men's store. Long since been closed down. They had felt hats for men and suits, really beautiful stuff. Shoe shop, all devoted to men. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a meeting place for businessmen. I remember on their counter they had a big cigar lighter. And the brass stood up there about 6 or 8 inches high. And the businessmen, I think majority of the businessmen in town hit there once a day, either in the morning or afternoon.
To talk about business or to smoke cigars?
Oh, just to smoke cigars and
anything.
Talk.
Anything.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did you do that?
No, I was too busy.
Uh-huh.
I did do some. I remember one thing I did. They had a big cabinet there with felt hats. And they needed some light, so I built neon lighting in behind all the hats there so it'd highlight them.
Uh-huh. Did that work?
Oh, it worked real well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were people happy with the signs that you made for them?
I don't really recall of very, very few times ever having anybody that wasn't happy with the work we did. Usually, I think one of the main problems we had is that we didn't have any competition in that kind of business. So they had no way of knowing prices. Mm-hmm. But I can honestly say that I was probably a third less than I should have been on all our pricing. Because we liked the town, we liked raising our kids here at the college and everything, I wanted to be friends with everybody. So, really, we didn't charge near what we should have. But on the other hand, they didn't know whether that was a good price or not. And once in a while, you'd find somebody that thought we were robbing them.
Huh.
When in fact, we were doing a lot less.
Were you aware of what the prices were for various items, say, over in Pendleton and areas?
Oh, yeah.
You knew these people?
If a Portland company came in here to bid on electrical sign, I knew I'd get the job because they were way higher than what I got.
Now, that brings up a question then. When you were dealing in these signs, was it through bidding or would they just call you up and say, I need a sign?
Both.
How did the bidding process work?
We had customers that we worked for years since, for instance, Boise Cascade. They'd got a place they never would even ask us a price. They'd just say, do it. But then, of course, there was others that we'd have to submit a sketch, usually a colored sketch of some type, especially if it was electric sign.
Would that be a full color sketch? Or?
Pretty
show
much
what
so.
The colors
yeah.
were
yeah.
going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How would bidding work?
Bidding?
If you had to bid with others, how would that work?
Well, we would present our sketch and the price on it, and they would present their sketch with the price.
Was that done in private or was it a group affair? Would you know what
did? Oh, no. You'd go and meet with the customer individually, and then you'd take what happened. Whatever happened.
And so you say if an out-of-towner came to bid on a sign, you could usually get it simply because your prices were lower?
Yeah, and I cultivated a good clientele. I mean, they backed me 100%. Majority of them. I don't like I say, I don't think I had very many enemies. Mm-hmm. And it got to the place that you hardly ever see anybody come in and bid against me.
So tell us, I guess, briefly or in a nutshell, how do you make a neon sign anyway?
Well,
I always wondered about that myself.
In a shop that does electrical signs, there's about five different trades, I believe it is. Sign painter in big shops. It'd be sign painter plus designers. Well, we combined that. And sheet metal man, electricians, sign electricians, sign installers, and servicemen. In big shops, those were all five different trades.
And so,
but we combined it in maybe two or three people.
Because you were a smaller operation,
yeah.
So you just did it. So, how does a neon sign get made?
How do you
make a neon sign?
Well, you start out, of course, with the sketch, the design, and all that, and then the sign painter, he'll make it.
We're continuing the interview with Mel Elder, August 1st, 2005. So we're talking about how we get our idea into production. So we've got a full-scale drawing.
Yeah, layout, and then sheet metal work starts. And usually there's quite a bit of angle iron built into it, depending on the installation type.
What is angle iron?
It'd be bars of, iron to reinforce, you know, if it's a projecting sign, then you have to have the legs projecting out where you can attach to the building. And,
okay.
And you have to make it structurally sound.
Yeah.
And as time went on, we were forced to have underwriters' laboratories inspect our signs so that they were up to
coil.
And then, of course, it was a neon sign. A neon tube bender got busy and formed the letters.
How does that work? How do you do that?
Well, we bought our neon tubing in 4-foot lengths. Mm-hmm. And you can get it in different sizes, like 10 millimeter, 12, 14, 18, 8, well, 8 millimeters was a popular size. But anyway, you buy the tubing with coating in it according to what color you're going to use. Like, if you wanted green, they had a fluorescent coating inside. And when it was completed, it would light up green. If you put argon gas in it. If you put neon gas in it, it light up gold. So you got different color combinations.
So it could be its basic color, or it could turn another one, just depending on which gas you put in.
Yes, it had two colors of gas.
Now, would you? Maybe I'm going too fast, but do you bend or form these before you put the gas in?
Oh yeah, you form them. And
how do you do that? How do you get them into?
Have a set of crossfires, and you hold it, and you mark the spot where you want to make a bend, whether it's a right angle bend or a U-bend, and you put that portion of glass in the fire and get it heated to a melting point, make your bend, and then all the time you've got a hose that you keep in your mouth. It's a blow hose with a cork on the end, in one end of the tube, and this hose plugged into the other end. We make that bend and then blow it out to the original side, because once you heated it, it collapsed.
So that's how you kept the inner space open then?
Yes.
Uh-huh. There was no gas in it at that time?
No.
Okay.
Just there.
Okay,
and
so.
So on each end of the, when you got the letter formed, you weld them together. usually in sections of maybe, 2 foot long. And each end of this section would have an electrode on it. And in the middle somewhere, we'd have a tubulation, which was the only outlet. Just a little fine tube. They'd weld it in, blow a hole in the neon tubing, and weld this tubulation glass on. And then when you got all that done, you put it on a vacuum pump. Weld that little tube to the manifold of the vacuum pump and draw air out of it. And you have a high voltage transformer. You put the leads to one end of the tube and the other end. When you get it up to a certain vacuum, you turn the high voltage on and it'd light up the whole tube. The air in there, just impurities. You'd just draw a little bit of air at a time. And all the time this is going on, it's heating. And it gets real hot. You lay a piece of white paper on there, and when it charred it, and you shut the voltage off and let it keep pumping, and it pump out all impurities, so it would be sterile inside the tube when you got through. And then eventually it'd be the vacuum pump would draw it up to a solid vacuum. And then you shut off the vacuum pump and let in a certain amount of gas, a small amount of gas, either neon or argon gas. And when you got that in there, because argon gas, which was blue, we had a mercury trap on the manifold of the pump, and we melt the tubulation off of the pump, then we dump that mercury in the tube, and then shake the mercury to each end of the, on the electrodes, and that's what caused the brilliance on those fluorescent colors, the blue gas.
Was the mercury inside?
Yeah, the mercury would vaporize it caused the brilliancy. Most fluorescent lights, light fixtures, each end of that's got mercury in them. That's how they get the brilliance.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, once you get up to a vacuum and let the gas in, dump mercury in, and then let the gas in, whichever, and you seal it off right at the tube. And it was ready to operate. And we, of course, there's crossovers that join the letters, and we'd have to block that out so it read good.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's ready to use. You have a hole in the sign, in the metal part, with electrodes, where the electrode's jacked in to make contact in there. Spring housing and transformers hooked up inside. Depending on the size of the sign, you may have one transformer, you may have half a dozen or more, or even more than that. And they operate on a high voltage, low amperage. That's about it. Of course, you have to, this metal part, in the meantime, the sign painter, he's been painting it and lettering it.
And the metal guy's been getting the support structure ready.
Yeah, they've had it all ready. And so then the sign electrician, he gets in there and wires all the transformers up to the electrodes, housings. Then you load it on the truck and hope you don't have an accident.
Did that ever happen?
Oh, yeah, it happened.
And what happens if those things break?
You make a U-turn and head back to the shop, redo whatever happened.
How about working with these chemicals, argon and mercury? First of all, are these signs made the same way today then?
Basically, yeah.
Uh-huh. Are there more restrictions about working with those? Mercury can be quite dangerous to work with.
I don't. Of course, I've been away from them for 21 years now, but I don't know of any restrictions.
Did you work with your hands?
We always did treat it with care, mercury, not try to inhale.
Did it get on your hands? Did you wear gloves?
No, I didn't wear any gloves. No, we didn't make contact with it as a rule. We used an eyedropper to put the mercury in the trap that we used.
Okay.
And no, we really, as a rule, didn't make contact with it.
Mm-hmm.
We realized that it's a dangerous.
Now, what about argon? That's a gas. Is there danger of working around that?
No, I don't know of any danger as far as argon or neon. They're both atmospheric gases.
Uh-huh.
You're breathing a certain amount of argon every time you breathe.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. Did you work around asbestos?
Well, yeah, our neon patterns, we've been our tubing. We had a bench here with our asbestos pattern. We bent all our tubing backwards. And when you picked it up, turned around, it's that's the way it's supposed to be. And, I worked with asbestos for years. And good chance that's one reason I've got a husky voice because of cancer I had in my vocal cord. I think I told you that.
You didn't work with masks or respirators around the asbestos?
No.
Uh-huh.
No.
Do you know if they do now, if they have to work around
it? They've done away with the asbestos. They came up with a different material, which is not as good as the asbestos, but it does.
Were you using this new material before you retired?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Just had started doing that.
Uh huh.
Yeah, they just taken the asbestos off of the market.
How about, would you like to tell us this story about doing some sign work for the Lux Rooms? We'd be very interested to hear.
Yeah. This was early on when we were still located down on Depot Street, just in the same block. There was a house of ill repute, set up business upstairs above what now is the Longhorn, Long Branch Cafe.
By a house of ill repute, would we be talking about prostitution?
Prostitution, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the madam that owned the house came to see us about a sign, and they wanted us to let her the door right there. It's on the ground level. Lux Rooms. Well, anybody that's familiar with that name, you knew what he was talking about. So
meaning it wasn't really a hotel?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Budweiser, he did the sign painting, and so he let her the door. She said, well, when you get through, come up and get paid. And so when he got through, he said, Mel, I said, I don't want to go up there myself. So we took a bill up there and handed it to her, and she said, oh, now do you want cash or do you want to take it out in trade? Mm-hmm. Well, we elected to take cash.
I see.
And I know that from all hearsay that they ran a good business. They weren't a real flop house. The girls she had working, they'd be out on the main street. They'd go in and buy the best clothes, and they really dressed first class. And the madam, she was the same way. And the city city had an understanding with him. You run a good business and we won't bother you. I don't know, I suppose there might have been some kind of a payoff. But I don't know how many years they lasted.
Would this have been was this one of your first signs, did you say, or just an early?
It was early time, on,
so
yeah.
Would have been 49 or into the early 50s then?
I'd say, yeah, around early 50s.
Were you aware of any other businesses like this that were around town?
There had been one over on this street that went from the Sacagawea across the tracks. That's Spruce.
Yeah.
There used to be one upstairs on Spruce above the tavern. But as I recollect, they'd gone out of business about the time we came to town.
And this was just common knowledge. People knew these places or businesses were around, whether they frequented them or not, which of course...
I think the majority of people realized that they were in business.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the downtown businesses, they knew.
Yeah. And of course, they had a great sign on their door.
Yeah.
That came from your business.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Did she pay cash for that sign?
Yes, she did.
Okay. About $12? Well, that might have been pretty spendy then.
Well, yeah, that's probably been money.
It might have been more than what it cost to go upstairs.
Yeah.
Let's see. Now, in addition to making signs, you said there were a couple other aspects to your business also. First of all, did you train or apprentice other people into the sign business while you owned your business?
Yeah, I think over the years I probably put about five fellows in through an apprenticeship, either sign electrician or sign painting.
Now, I'm not all that familiar with the trades, but so would you hire these people on and they would work for you for a certain length of time in order to get their experience that they needed to get their license,
right,
or
right,
card or whatever?
And so, as a matter of fact, later on, we hired people from the same family, Ralph Moore and his sons. I forget now, let's see, there was Steve and Dave. I think that's one of them, and then others of Matt Barber's family, and had several of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a family affair there. And finally, I got to thinking, well, I'm going to want to get out of this sometime. So we incorporated. And sold, or in fact they gave the employees a share. So when we got out of business, it was a matter of selling our shares.
I see.
I had controlling interest, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bought my shares.
And that's how the business was transferred.
Right, right.
Kept you from having to put a for sale sign out.
And absolutely, yeah.
I see.
Yeah,
so
it
now,
worked out good.
When your apprentice is working for you, did they work for the same rate of pay they would get if they had a card? Or did they typically work for less while
they
were apprenticing?
Started out less, yes.
Uh-huh.
And the apprenticeship council kept track of us, making sure that everything was going the way it should be. And
did you have to complete paperwork or evaluate
them in such a way?
Oh,
yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
What sort of evaluation skills or what sort of things?
You had to upgrade them or downgrade them, whichever the case may be. In our case, it was upgrading after, we'll say, every 6 months, something like that. I don't remember the exact length of time, but every so often you have to fill out upgrade
And what is upgrading?
Well, to show that they have been there so long and that they are capable of doing their job and getting to be more capable.
So, for example, it's just basically sort of letting them know what more they could do than the last time.
Right, yeah.
Now they know how to do this and this and this,
yeah.
Or they're competent now at this and this and this,
yeah.
And that kind of... Then did you keep these people on when they finished their apprenticeship?
Yeah. Of course, this depends on the individual. One of the first fellows that I put through apprenticeship was Dave Larson. And I think he worked for me for about five or six years. And he approached me one day and he says, I wonder if I was to get a leave of absence for 3 months or whatever it was, he said, I'd like to go to Oklahoma to horseshoeing school. Well, I said, if you have a mind made up you want to do that, I said, that'd be fine. I'll try and get along without you, and when you come back, we'll go to work. But when he came back, he said, I want to go to horseshoeing all full time, which he has been ever since. He's retired now from it. But I had him get his journeyman card, so he was there long enough to do that. But that was the last of his sign work.
But ordinarily, you tried to hang on to the people, so
you
would maybe get, you wanted to be comfortable with them anyway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Steve Moore, which is Ralph's oldest son, he was the best apprenticeship I ever had. And I taught him the neon tube bending. And he learned the sheet metal work and the installations. He knew the whole thing. He wasn't a sign painter. But other than that, he could do anything. And eventually he went to work for Art Craft Signs out of Salt Lake. They had a shop in Sacramento, and I don't know, they had a whole bunch of them. They had one in Boise, and a big outfit. And he became their top neon tube bender. Very good. He got better than I ever was. And eventually he came back and worked for the boys that bought us out. His dad, his brother-in-law, and worked for them for several years, I think it was, and then he decided to go out on his own, so he's up at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in sign business up there, and he still does Matt Barber neon tube bending.
From up there?
Yeah, he sent it back down.
Huh.
But he was excellent.
So we talked about you were the, is there a particular title that you have when you lead other apprentices? Are you called a trainer or a teacher?
No, in order to meet state qualifications, we had to be journeyman.
So that would have been the title.
Yeah.
So you were a journeyman and that qualified you to lead or teach others then?
Journeyman, sign electrician, yeah.
Okay. Then you said also that another part of your business was sign servicing of the electrical signs.
Oh yeah.
What did that entail? And
well, of course, it depended a lot on the size of the sign. We had signs in different places that you'd run the crane up there and crawl up and get right inside the sign and maybe spend a couple hours in there solving the problems and rectifying them. And others are little stick-out signs that work off the ladder or whatever, and repair short, maybe it was short on a sign, right, or a burned out transformer, or broken neon tubing.
Mm-hmm.
In the case where with plastic signs, it was usually either fluorescent lamps that needed replacing, or replace the transformer and ballast.
Was there any need to clean these signs, or did they have different
people to do that? We did considerable amount of that. Matter of fact, we had a 12-volt pump, high-pressure pump, right on the service rig. The long hose, we could take up one ladder and wash the inside of those plastic signs.
You were telling me, based on this photograph, about the Bonnenkamp sign, wasn't it? This appears to be a ladder that's next to the sign.
Yes.
Did you build that ladder with the sign?
No, we didn't build that sign. We serviced it. It was there when I came to town.
So you were telling me about one of your staff was up there cleaning that sign. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we were repainting the sign. I was down on the ground. He was up near the top of the sign repainting, and had a little can of paint there that he was working out of, and all of a sudden it slipped, came down, hit the edge of the marquee, right down below, and flipped right over on a car. So we had a real job of cleaning up paint.
Was that oil-based paint then?
Oh, yeah.
So that wouldn't have been easy to clean up.
No, we got right on it, wiped a lot of it off while it was still wet, and then we had to take mineral spirits and finish wiping it down.
Did that do anything to the paint of the car itself?
No, it didn't seem to affect it any. I think one time we did that, we just turned it over to insurance and let them take care of it.
Oh. So you were insured for an event like that to begin with?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Almost had to be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Hmm. Then you told me one of your customers was, either one of your customers, or we just talked about it as a business that isn't there anymore, and that's this Idaho-owned, or KOB.
Oh, yeah, Falk's ID store. You notice in one of those photographs that you can see their sign.
Oh yeah, here it is.
Yeah.
Next to a Fountain Drug and a bank on the other
that
side, just before Lawrence and Jewelry there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they were Idaho owned. I think there was only about three Falk's IDs at that time.
Now,
there were several, but
was that part of their name, Idaho owned? Because
yeah,
it says ID store. So
yeah. Falk's ID store.
That talked about Idaho?
I think, yeah. That stood for Idaho Department Store.
Oh, so were these things like products that originated out of Idaho?
Oh, not particularly. No, they were just like any other dry goods store.
So it was a department?
Yeah, they had complete wardrobe, men and women and children. And it was just a really nice working man's store.
Did you do this sign or the sign work for them?
No, that's an old one. Was there when we came. I sure worked on it a number of times, though.
So you serviced their sign?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so they were one of your customers for this servicing of the sign business. Okay, well, you know, on these postcards that we're looking at, there's a ton of signs on Adams right here, just on this five-block stretch.
Yeah, there's a
that
ton
doesn't
of them
even
out
cover
there.
The rest of LeGrand.
Yeah.
So
you see the Sacagawea sign, of course. That hotel's all gone, and in the block just beyond it, that burned about a half a block burned up at one time. Matter of fact, I had the sign aerial truck down there helping fight the fire. There was called the Noodle Parlor, was a Chinese place, floral shop, photographer, and I guess maybe one or two other businesses burned out. Started at night.
Is that Is that what caused the demise of the Sacagawea Hotel, was this fire?
No, it had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
No, it wasn't in the same block even.
Oh, I see.
No, the U.S. National Bank decided they wanted a bank there, and so they bought the building and had it demolished. That's the saddest thing that ever happened to LeGrand.
You're not the first person that I heard say that.
Yeah. See, right now today, with a building like that, they would have, somebody came along and converted it to apartments.
Or even had a nice downtown hotel again.
Yeah, downtown hotel.
There is no hotel on, there's no hotel period.
No.
Here, they're all motels.
Well, then there was the Folio Hotel on down.
Up on the other
on the right
end.
Side, maybe the other,
yeah
way
right
down
there.
There.
We see
yeah.
The Folio Hotel.
Yeah, it was a third class motel, or hotel compared to the Sacagawea, but it was in business when we were here. Did a good business at one time.
Did you ever stay in any of these hotels?
I don't think we did, no. The only time we stayed in a motel here was when we first moved to LeGrand for about three nights. We stayed at the LeGrand Motel out on East Adams, which has no longer been there.
Yeah, I think in my notes here that you and the Weiser family stayed in that hotel together, wasn't it?
Yeah, motel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, there is another item here on the sign servicing thing. Your territory actually was outside of LeGrand as well as in it.
Oh yeah.
How far did you go?
Made a living just in LeGrand.
Uh-huh.
We went over in Idaho and up in Washington. We did all of Chevron. Sign servicing and lighting
for the region.
Bend.
Huh.
And then one of our best customers bought a Coca-Cola bottling company, which was in Walla Walla. We worked over there up at Dayton, Washington. Did a lot of work there and over Tri-Cities. Can't wait.
So you'd have to travel, would you have to stay overnight in these places?
Sometimes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, we'd round trip it though. We'd leave here at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning and get home at 10 o'clock at night or so.
Now, was any of this work before the freeway opened?
Oh, we came here in 49 and I don't know, it's when the freeway opened. I'd say late 50s anyway, or early 60s.